Ahoy, ahoy. Welcome to Head Games, the science and psychology of sports. I'm Dr. Brett Levine, joined as always by Dr. Ben Rosenberg. Our guest today is the editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus, which is basically the Bible for baseball nerds, which basically makes our guest some sort of saint. Craig Goldstein, welcome to Head Games.
Thank you for having me.
That's saint.
I guess
saint
I feel
Craig.
I need to be a saint to be on the line. I'm not a doctor, extremely not a doctor. So
you're a saint. That's a lot better.
Trust me. Seems above. I think that's above a PhD.
Yeah, yeah. You can bypass all the coffee stains and the human tears. So you're in good shape. So you guys, okay, so this is weird. So you guys actually kind of like met and knew each other in Vegas at, what was it, Thunder Down Under? Where were you guys at?
First it was Thunder Down Under, yeah. Followed by, what's the other one we were at, Craig?
Oh man, it's hard to, I don't know the names. I just take it all in, you know?
All the dicks blend together.
Man. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, there are so many signs. Whoever's handing out something on the street, I just take it and that's it.
all the strip club cards, we just go with those guys. Hop in their limos, I mean, whatever.
Oh man. Well, Craig, thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to.
I'm sure you have many BP shirts lying around the house.
I've got a few, yeah.
We heard that, and I don't know if this is getting too statsy for you, but I think it's not. Mm-hmm. We heard that in terms of like the best prediction mechanisms in analytics, that we're getting like 80 something percent variance explained. Like, you know, some of the best prediction models out there are like taking up major, major chunks of variance. Like, is that what you heard? Is it somewhere around like 80 something?
I off the top of my head, I really don't know. I can ask, like, so I'm fairly like, you know, I have some facility with that kind of stuff, but I probably haven't read on like the hardcore projection stuff. We obviously do our own. And like we have a stats team. And again, if like you want to get into stuff with that, I'd be happy to connect you guys with them. But like Jonathan Judge does a lot of our proprietary analytics, and we have a group of people, but he's kind of the engine behind them. Cool. And like I don't know anywhere else that like for projection stuff for baseball, we post our standard deviations and stuff like that throughout the year so that like you can see how wide and how much certainty we have around, you know, surrounding various metrics that we provide. And because we try and just be kind of honest about like, you know, sometimes like we have, and that's not purely predictive, obviously, but our proprietary sets like deserved runs created plus and deserved run average, those two especially are really good at being both descriptive and predictive. That's kind of what they're built to do. And so because they're good at being predictive, we want to provide people kind of the uncertainty surrounding them so that when we say like, you know, this person is whatever percent better than league average, you know, there's an error bar there. And if someone else is within three, you know, we might be more confident of the guy who's worse, so to speak, than the guy we have is better. And that way you can weigh it yourself, right? We all look at these things and then say like, you know, There are assumptions built into all of them. There's variance that gets, you know, adjusted for in all of them. And there are different approaches for doing that. And the reality is most of our users, our readers, you know, anyone who's using any of these advanced stats isn't digging into like the underlying philosophical approach. Okay. And thus it's necessarily going to say like, you know, it's like with anything with wins above replacement. It's like, oh, this guy has 7 and this guy has 6.7. That guy's clearly better. Well, kind of like, you know, there are a lot of reasons that might not be true. And it depends where you land on like what the approach is. And it's not that one's wrong and one's right. It's just about how you want to go about weighing those things. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that wasn't a great way to, I don't know the answer to your question, is the honest one, but I can talk a lot around.
That's good. Good enough.
I think, you know, the basis of it was actually theoretical. It was basically going to say like, okay, let's say we can predict a big chunk. Let's say like our prediction methods, especially for baseball compared to other sports.
Yeah.
Really impressive. How do we get to, do you think we can get infinitely close to 100%? And if so, are there other types of science that we should be including besides just using previous performance, like psychology or physics or biology, or like, how do we get closer to basically increasing our level of prediction?
So, yeah, I do think we can get closer. And I absolutely think that we should be using other disciplines in science. Like I'm a huge, so this is a bit of a tangent, but I do think it's moderately relevant. Like I'm a huge fan of behavioral economics and that mm-hmm. like, that field in general. And mm-hmm. it's obviously the combination of two different disciplines, right? It's psychology and it's economics. And it answers things in a more realistic way than economics does on its own. Yeah. I don't want to say it answers things in a way that psychology doesn't. I think it has a lot to do with, I think the value of it is applying the psychology to the economics. Yeah. Because what we talk about when we talk about like a rational actor, and this applies to baseball too, right? It's you know, we talk about baseball markets all the time, and there are a lot of different ones, but we have to talk about like why and how teams behave in those markets, and you know, how they act, especially in this current place in time with these let's say interesting off seasons. It's all about what they think a player will do, right? It is projection. That's what you're talking about. They're relying on projection, and we as an industry still rely mostly on how, like, we provide analysis based on what's been done historical, like you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
Because that's mostly what we have access to. And teams, I think there was a point that the public private gap was pretty small. And I think it's expanding a little bit again, with certain Statcast things. We do get things from Statcast, from MLB, but we don't get the raw data as much, and we can't build on the raw data the way that kind of a huge hive mind of public analysts could, in terms of making it better, or not even making it better, making the metrics that we can pull from it kind of better in that way. And so I definitely think, to go back to your question, we can improve by applying different disciplines. When it's psychology, when it's, you know, these other things, it is biology, it is, you know, how we age, how people, you know, what is quick twitch versus slow twitch when you talk about scouting? What, you know, how do those age differently? When you look at someone's bat speed, can you, at a certain age, can you start having more confidence in your ability to predict that they're going to have a slower bat, they're going to have to start cheating on pitches earlier? So that brings in their hand-eye coordination, their pitch identification, that brings in their biology and their chemistry for like how good are their eyes? How good can you make their eyes via LASIK or contacts or things like that, right?
Yeah.
There are all those kind of spiraling things. So I do think we can get better, and I do think we can get closer to, you know, being actually predictive. I never think you're going to reach it. And I don't think it's going to be like 99th percentile, getting closer, closer, closer. I think it's probably going to be about, if we're going to say take 80% where it is, you know, somewhere between 80 and 85%, because there are way too many things that we just don't have access to. And even if we did have access to, I find a lot of ethical conundrums in applying those types of things. And I'm sure that there's a name for the thing, but you kind of put your thumb on the scale when you start applying, especially psychological things. I'm sure you guys could educate me on that better than I can speak to myself. But like, when you start applying or talking about like, this is a thing that this situation is in. I mean, even as something as basic as like, if a player starts hearing, oh, maybe he's a change of scenery guy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he might start thinking, maybe I need to change the scenery. It becomes self-fulfilling prophecy, yeah, type of thing. And I think those things absolutely exist on their own without people kind of influencing the players themselves. But I don't know how you start introducing them, you know, into the surrounding culture, the surrounding conversation, without potentially changing those outcomes in the process.
Yeah. My colleague, who's a professor at Chapman down in SoCal, who someday we're going to have on, did some research on something like what you're talking about. I, of course, can't remember the effect or whatever he called it. But basically, as soon as you name something, even if it's a statistic, it loses some value or loses some meaning. Right. So as soon as we started labeling saves or holds or whatever, they automatically lose some value simply by quantifying them in that way. So I think you're on the nose. I mean, the other thing that's involved is something that we talk about all the time. It's called measurement error, which is that you're never going to get to 100% because none of these measures are perfect, right? Some of these objective indicators that baseball is so fortunate to have are pretty close to perfect because they just are what they are. But as soon as you go away into any other field, anything we measure isn't perfect. Like, as psychologists, nothing we measure is perfect. There's always some chunk that of what we're capturing that's error. So we can never get to 100%.
Yeah, and the math way of dealing with that is to normalize in some sense, yeah. You know, and you go back and do that. But there are things that don't actually get normalized. I mean, you look at, if you want to track like the kind of the progression of advanced statistics in baseball, let's just take pitching, for example. There's fielding independent pitching, right? FIP. And it tries to isolate the things that pitchers are good at, strikeouts, walks, and allowing home runs. And there were always guys that would have FIPs that would outperform their ERA. And people kind of at the time, this was, I want to say, like, you know, maybe a little bit before 2010, 2008 to 2012, something in that range. What's it, Matt Cain for the Giants was like a big one of those, if we're just remembering some guys. And like he was a guy whose FIP was always way better than his ERA. Yeah. And it was because FIP, and especially XFIP, which neutralized a little bit further, the park factors and home run rates and stuff like that. It applied a league average home run rate to all the pitchers. The problem with that is that, so it's not a problem on a mass approach, right? Like it's probably fair because you're dealing with a huge data set and you're saying, mm-hmm. we're going to take the average home run per fly ball approach for all of these guys. And when you're trying to project forward, your mean, right, you're going to get closer to a mean on that. But where you're going to miss are on outliers. And Matt Cain was an outlier, but there was a reason he was an outlier. He pitched at the top of the zone before it was in vogue. He had a straight fastball, right? Like, guys could hit it. Now, guys often couldn't hit it, but when they did, it went very far. And so his home run per fly ball rate was often very elevated. And so you have someone who shows a skill set that is both good at limiting walks, good at missing bats because he's pitching at the top of the zone, but then bad at limiting homers. And it wasn't an accident. So applying a league average home run rate to Matt Cain was wrong. And you're never going to be predictively accurate if you take that particular approach. You have to get down into more of a nitty gritty, individualized approach to something like that. But when you start to do that, you lose other things, right? And so like, predictive, you know, and again, we deal with this with Pakoda, our projection system, but there are others out there. Fangraphs uses one called Steamer, one called Zips. There's a lot out there. You'll find, and they battle this too, and like Dan Zimborski, who does Fangraphs, Zips projections, is really open about his process. But like, it's always a battle of like, you can get more correct when you do start doing RSME, you know, RMSEs and stuff like that.
Mean squares.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. When you start clustering things around the mean. But is that the most accurate way to do projections? Because now you're missing out on outlier, you know, okay, if you regress Mike Trout towards the mean hard, you might be more right about everybody else because you're clustering them, but you also know Mike Trout is not anything like the mean. So you know, trying to pull him back when he's different. And again, there are a lot of guys that are different. Juan Soto is a straight up freak, right? You know, like pulling him back towards most 19, you know, what most 19 or 20 or 21 year olds do in their second or third year in the majors. It just doesn't work for someone like that. So you have to decide as a, you know, what your philosophy is in a, when you're trying to project forward and be accurate, is how do you get the average guys around average and let the other guys, you know, who are bad and good
kind of oscillate.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Instead of, so the mean is like, I think a fair approach. I think it's a basic approach. We tried this. Remember, Ben, when we were doing the Berkmont stuff that we tried like a prediction model with NFL players and we used Euclidean distance, and I don't know enough about that to talk about it.
Yeah.
But the idea was, instead of just taking like the league mean, that you create clusters. So you don't compare Mike Trout to the average, but you compare Mike Trout to players who are similar to him.
Similar to him.
And then you say, okay, based on this cluster here, how much, you know, how much more accurate could I be than just predicting to the mean there? Do you know of any modeling that works like that, or how advanced is modeling getting in that regard? Or is it just really a trade-off, like you said, like depending on your method, you can get closer or farther away. It just kind of depends on, you know, where the chips fall.
So I'll say two things. I am 100% not the person to talk intelligently about that kind of thing.
You're doing a good job.
You're doing a really good job. Yeah.
Because I just like, I stopped taking, I don't think I even took a math. I took a stats course in college, right? Or in business school. I didn't take math courses in college. Like, it's just, that's not, I topped out at a certain level. It was not very high, but like, I do know. So we have a stats team. Like I said, we have a Slack specifically for them. And like, have I seen them talk about stuff with that approach? The Euclidean distance and stuff like that. I have. I don't specifically remember if it's what we use. I don't think it is, but I do know what we do use. And again, this was kind of introduced by Jonathan Judge, is our, we both Deserve Run Creative Plus, DRC Plus, and DRA, Deserve Run Average, use mixed modeling approaches. Mm. So he is applying different models at the same time to try and separate those things and still provide that same thing. Again, the way I just said it, he would probably say, that's not exactly what I'm doing, and here's how it actually works. But it is... It's a mixed model approach. I mean, we have, and we documented, and it's all, so our website is a subscription site, but any research that we do, anything that we do where we introduce a metric or anything like that is always 100% free, because we want people to read it. We want to have feedback on it. They produce everything that they do and that kind of stuff through R. And so like, if you have R, they give you the ability to go into a GitHub and, you know,
run
those scripts and do all of that kind of stuff. So like, we have explainer articles, and I'm happy to provide them if you want to have links for people to check them out or anything like that. So those will give you a better understanding than I could possibly give you. And I don't think it's the Euclidean approach, but I do know he applies a mixed modeling approach to get the numbers that we get.
So it's too bad because we're having so much fun, and I want to get to this because I think it's important. 2020 was such a great year. 2021 hopefully is a little bit better. However, in terms of baseball, I don't think it's off to the best start. We lost Tommy Lasorda, we lost Don Sutton, and Friday we lost Hank Aaron. Passed away at the age of 86. 755 home runs, 3,771 hits, never tied to steroids, was always well regarded. Craig, can you put into some perspective what we've lost?
Honestly, I can't. And that's not, I mean, some of that is a reflection on me, I'll be honest, but mostly it's a reflection on who, and speaking specifically to Hank Aaron, who he was and what he did. I'm not a great historian of the game. It's just never been my forte, but I mean, you look at what he did. I was looking at it the other day. I mean, and this is just the stats side, which is not close to the full picture of what Hank Aaron did and who he was, but he led the league in OPS at 25, and he did it again with a better OPS at 37, and he had a better OPS at 39, even though he didn't lead the league in OPS that year. I mean, he's like one of the most consistent performers there's ever been, and that's from, I mean, he never had more than 46 home runs, which 46 is a lot, to be clear. Or sorry, it might've been 47 home runs. But when you look at Barry Bonds, for example, who passed him, had 74 in a season. Mm-hmm. So he got to the number he got to without ever hitting 50 home runs. I mean, it's staggering. I mean, the consistency was just remarkable. And then, you know, I've kind of been seeing a lot more coverage and kind of trying to appreciate and take in the off the field things. When you talk about what he had to go through, where he had to do it, you know, there's been a lot of reporting about how his kids were had the FBI protection when he was on the verge of breaking Babe Ruth's mark, you know, what he had to deal with. And he did it with, and I want to be careful here, because it's very easy to talk about like dignity and his quietness. He shouldn't have had to do those things, but he did have to have a quiet dignity because of the racism he faced, the threats his family faced, all of that sort of stuff. impacted how he chose to deal with it, but he shouldn't have been in that position to choose. Like, there's nothing, there's no difference in his character had he been a vocal, you know, someone speaking out against it more than he did, although he did quite a lot, especially when he felt less threatened to do so, right? And you can look back at some of the things that he's given, some amazing interviews. If I Had a Hammer is an incredible book based on his life, and he talks about how, like, the threats that he got and the treatment that he received in pursuit of Babe Ruth's record took, like he said, like it carved out a piece of my soul, my heart, that like it just didn't come back for him. And he was just, the fact that he has so many quotes that are, to me, poetry about what he lost. And it is such a, by experiencing those things, and it's such a shame that we, you know, I don't know, that someone as gentle and as good as he appeared to be, and we can get into this, I'm sure, later, but like, there are so many things about, you know, don't have heroes, don't make athletes your heroes. And there are a lot of valid reasons why not to do that. Hank Aaron was like legitimately someone you could have as your hero and never feel bad about it ever.
Hmm.
And it's just, I can't put into perspective what that loss is. I think one of the best things I saw, and I know I'm rambling, so I apologize, but one of the best things I saw was Jeff Heckelman, who used to work with the league, was talking about this on Twitter. And he said he was in charge of organizing kind of the Hank Aaron, there would be a Hank Aaron award presentation every year during the World Series. And so, you know, he got to watch major league players kind of get ready before they were about to go up and talk to and meet Hank and go talk to him. And he said at one point, someone kind of was like, do I look okay? Is it on point? And he kind of just kind of chuckled and was like, yeah, you're fine. And the guy said, it's Hank fucking Aaron. And like, that's like, to today's stars, that's what he meant to them.
Mm.
Right? That's, you had to look your best. You had to be your best because it was Hank Aaron. And like, I don't know a better way. Like, that's, you know, one part of it. It's just like, as much as jaded as we can be about our star athletes and stuff like that, and as much reason as they can give us to be that way, he was truly a hero, right? Like, he made them feel like a little kid. He installed that nervousness that we get in a lot of other scenarios in these guys who go out and perform in front of tens of thousands of people every night. And I mean, that's just how big he was.
Yeah. I think it's hard for us to quantify, as you said, right? Sitting here in 2021, and we obviously were not around when he was chasing and breaking the record, but hearing the stories of people who are either around the game or just were existing in that time period. Like, I asked my dad about it actually this morning, if he remembered when he broke the record. He was like, yeah, of course. Like, everybody from that era who was alive then remembers both the chase, because here's a Black man in the Deep South chasing this hallowed record, and then also the moment when he broke it. So
yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think you mentioned Don Sutton and Tommy Lasorda. I'm a Dodgers fan because my dad was a Dodgers fan. Obviously, they meant a lot to that franchise. But it's just been, so we produce an annual every year, a book that we finished in early January. And most of the copy was done as of the end of last year. And one of our essays is Stephen Goldman, who is a historian of the game, who writes at BP and was editor-in-chief before me, is several people before me. But he wrote about all the people we lost in 2020. Yeah. And it's just, I was talking to him, I said this about Don Sutton, and this was before Hank Aaron passed, but like, it is relentless. The amount, the institutional knowledge, the representativeness of all of these guys that we lost. I mean, and they're legends. I mean, you know, like Darren Sutton, Don Sutton's son, is on XM, or has been on Sirius XM radio, on the MLB network, stuff like that. I mean, like, these guys are drenched in baseball and vice versa. And it's, I don't know. It's a stunning number of losses. I mean, the number, I mean, Lou Brock last year, Tom Seaver, Rich Allen, Dick Allen. I mean, like, it's unbelievable. And you know, a lot of it is COVID related. That's kind of the spin that Stephen put on it in the book. But like, it's stunning to have written that essay and see the totality of it. And then immediately after we send it off to the printers, it's like Lasorda, Sutton, Aaron. I mean, it's just devastating. I don't have the words. It's really tough.
Yeah. As a baseball fan, I'm like, I don't know when I'd have this opportunity, but like selfishly, it's like, I never got to meet him. You know, I never got a chance to like, you know, see if I look at him, it's fucking Hank Aaron. I better look good. I go shake his head or something like that. But
100%. But you know, and I wanted to mention on Aaron, like this is the other thing is like, maybe you wouldn't, but like he was accessible for being Hank Aaron. He was accessible. And I talked about his off-field stuff, but he also knew what he meant to people, what he meant to the game, but what he meant to people. And he carried himself in a way that was, you know, demonstrative of what he wanted reflected, you know, what he wanted people to see him embody. He, January 5th, he was getting a COVID shot and he did it publicly.
Wow.
He wanted to make sure that the people who looked up to him made sure that they understood like this was a thing that they should be doing, that it was safe, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And that's, I mean, to the end, that's who he was in the end. And he understood, you know, the power that he wielded as a star and as someone who was respected for their civil rights, for their, you know, everything that they did off the field.
Yeah. It is. I mean, we'll talk a little bit later. We were going to play a Hall of Fame game, but and he has both of these things. Number one, he's got the stats, obviously. Yeah. But like, I also feel like, I think this is pretty much a fact at this point, that the Hall of Fame vote is also a vote on people's characters. And
more and more.
More and more. And it's, and like, if you factor both of those things in with Hank Aaron, it's kind of just like, can anybody get close? Like, Ruth was incredible, but like, it's not really a great guy. I think cheated on his wife and just kind of, you know.
Yeah, Ty Cobb's a raging racist. I mean, there's all these instances throughout the history of the game. Yeah, we'll come back to that thought, I think, in a bit. But I think a second sort of, I don't know if somber is the right word, but downer of a follow-up is this week, the other big interesting thing that happened in baseball is that the Mets had recently hired Jared Porter to be their GM and then fired him shortly thereafter, right after this story came out about him sending unwanted text messages of his private parts to a female reporter. So unfortunately, this seems like it's probably not going to be the last time something like this happens in baseball, which is kind of an old boys club. And I guess just wanted to ask if you had any thoughts about what it's going to take to change the culture. Like, why are we still doing this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a complicated issue. So Patrick Dubuque, one of our authors, wrote about this the night it happened. And I think one part of what he said really stuck with me, which is that, you know, it's very unlikely that that's the last time this is going to happen. And in all likelihood, it has already happened. The next one of these we find is something that's going to be, I mean, this was from 2016, 2017.
Right.
This incident that just surfaced. So like in all likelihood, this is not only going to happen again, but the again is something that's already been perpetrated. And it's not, and not to say that you framed it in any ill-fitting way, but like, it's not just that it was unwanted messages of his private parts, but like 62, I think, consecutive texts that were not responded to. I mean, it's not worth drawing the distinction, but it's all harassment, right? Like 62 straight texts. To me, that's like clinical. Like what is, I don't even know how you go about explaining that. And I think that's why they fired him. Like there's no explanation for that. And there's no excuse for it. And I should also point out that different circumstances, but just for the Mets, the second straight offseason that they've hired someone and then fired them before they actually did anything for the franchise, right? Carlos Beltran was hired as the manager of the Mets, and then the banging scheme scandal unfolded, and they fired him before he managed a game. So just a tough couple of off seasons for the Mets, but some of which I don't think Beltran they should be blamed for, but they brought on themselves. I thought Hannah Kaiser of Yahoo Sports, when Sandy Alderson did a press conference following the firing, said, you know, did you talk to any women in the process of hiring him? And the answer was no. Now, the answer is no because the state of baseball is what in terms of who he worked with, who are you going to ask for you know, he certainly didn't have any women that were bosses. You know, Kim Ng is the first general manager, the first woman general manager in baseball history. That's this offseason with the Marlins. So you're not going to talk to anyone there. I absolutely think it's worth talking to people someone managed when you're hiring them in that process. I don't know if he hired any, if he managed any women or not. And I also, I honestly don't know the answer on, like, should you be asking reporters their opinion on a general manager hire? I lean towards probably not, but like, I would understand if someone maybe thinks that that's a relevant point to see like how they interact with the media or not. But I also think letting the media have impact on, you know, an influence on your hiring process. I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that. And it's something I'd be willing, very willing to listen to people with various arguments on it. I think, you know, I think in terms of what it is going to take to change this, I think a lot of people say like, oh, hire women. And that's a little bit of maybe an implication of what I just said. I don't think that solves it. I don't think, you know, there are women who are tolerant of things that they shouldn't be tolerant of too, probably more sensitive than to things that, you know, like this than men, but you never know. And I don't think it's purely that. I think you just have to, how you change a culture is something I've been super interested in. I went to like I mentioned, I was I have an MBA. I went to business school, and I was really interested in organizational kind of culture and philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I found the answer to any. I was very interested in like, how do you create culture? And I never really, there are all these case studies, right, about culture. I read about Netflix four different times, legitimately four different times about Netflix and their culture. But there's not a manual on like how to do it and how to influence it. And the best answer that I've found as an editor in chief, someone who manages people, who has people that report to him, stuff like that, is to act out the things that you believe in, demonstrate what you believe in. At Baseball Prospectus, I was not the editor in chief at the time. I was the minor league editor, but I don't know if you guys are familiar with Luke Heimlich. He was a first round talent, probably a mid first round talent who went to Oregon State. He was valued very highly on draft boards and stuff heading into his draft year. But before the season started, it came out that he had a charge against him from like molesting a young girl when he was younger. And it came out, he was on a, I'm blanking on, but you know, like one of the reports that you can get them, you know, a neighborhood watch report, whatever, because he didn't check in with something, whatever. How we choose to, how do you cover that, right? That's a question as a media entity that we had to, you know, I was covering our prospect team, our minor league coverage. Like how do we want to approach that? Do you want to just talk about him as an on-field talent, right? Mm. And ignore that? Do you want to always talk about him, but every single time provide context? Do you want to not talk about him because in your view, it is something that is disqualifying? And as much as people might be interested in how hard and how well he can throw his fastball and how well he can control it, that's really not what's pertinent in this discussion. Our approach, and I talked it over with kind of our senior staff on that side, was to say, we're not going to cover him. That's just like whatever the league decides to do, however, whether a team decides to draft him, he ultimately went undrafted, by the way. However the league decides to handle it, however teams decide to handle it, their motivations are much different than ours. And their motivations tend to be about profit first and foremost, and then how well they can win. And the intersection of that is like, can you get someone at a reduced price because of some horrible thing that they've done? And we've seen that with Roberto Osuna. We've seen that time and again. And so my faith was not in the league to handle this or individual teams to handle this very well. And I said, I'm going to take it out of their hands. I don't want to talk about this guy. I don't want to give him the light of day. And we had on staff, we've had people who were abuse survivors. And talking about someone who had conducted themselves in this way, and by the way, pled guilty in this process when he was younger. So when he was younger, It was due to be expunged, that kind of thing. But like pled guilty to it, and that's what we know. Bringing him up, exposing them to that is, and you know, I understand certain people are going to react to this word, but like it can be triggering. Mm-hmm. And I thought the path of least damage is that like I don't need to expose them to that. To that. Now, other people handle it differently. Like I said, I know another publication said we're going to talk about him, but we're going to bring this up every time so people know who it is. I think that's a perfectly valid thing. All of this is, I know that's a tangent and I apologize, but all of that is to say, like, how to change culture is to act on what you believe and to make sure people understand what went into the process. And for baseball and this old boys club, or, you know, increasingly like a new boys club, like it's young, they're young. No, I mean, it is like, it's, you know, it's a lot of people in their 30s, Ivy League educated.
Yep.
Blah, blah. Yeah. Like it's very much like an old boys club, but there's some new spins on it. I think you have to get good people. You have to get people who are willing to act on good ethical like frameworks. And I talk about this all the time in terms of just the competition aspect in baseball, because teams are tanking, teams are, you know, are manipulating service time, things like that. This is not good faith behavior. And this is not only not good faith behavior, it's just abusive behavior. But like, you need people who understand that, like, the goal isn't the end, right? You know, like it's the means. Like you have to do the means right to get to the right ends, and that subverting the means to get to the ends you want, whether it's more wins, whether it's more money, whether it's a night with somebody, none of that's okay. And you need people who actively think that way and just will act in good faith on all of those terms, on all of the terms that they encounter. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to do it aside from just changing, because I think when you have leadership that does that, people follow it and say, that's how I advance now, right? I reflect the values that our leadership and our ownership and all of that kind of stuff kind of espouse, and not only espouse, but walk as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, it's funny, this came up a lot over the last 4 years for a certain reason is, as a society, what do we value in terms of moral or ethical behavior, and why does it matter? And it's certainly come up in sports, and you hit on it with Roberto Osuna. And I was thinking about Kareem Hunt and a lot of these players into some really gruesome shit that are still given, you know, a podium and still given an opportunity to play, because at the end of the day, people say, this is a fucking business and we want to sell tickets, and people's memories are short and you forget. And I bet you if you polled people right now, a lot of people wouldn't remember what Roberto Osuna or Kareem Hunt did.
Nope.
And that's the trade-off, right? And I don't know. I mean, it's gruesome and it's terrible. And it's like, okay, fine. Like maybe it's this philosophy of nice guys finish last, right? And you want to be an organization that runs yourself ethically and hires the right people and whatever. And, you know, in the end, it is about business and people's memories are short. But like, we just can't. I mean, I think like, we can't do this. We can't say that a sport exists to spread joy and to make people happy. And yet here we are, you know, bringing up these people or allowing, you know, these people to exist. And to your point, triggering people, you know, or I think bringing up sensitive things that have happened to people and hurting, it should not be a hurtful thing, right? I mean, I understand that like there's certain phobias out there. Like if you have a phobia of round objects, you probably shouldn't watch sports. But like if, you know, I think if this is a pervasive cultural issue, that you're right. Like we just have to draw a line somewhere and say, you know, our athletes shouldn't be this way. Our president shouldn't be this way. Like there are effects beyond this as well. Like not just, you know, hurting someone based on what's happened to them, but also like, where does it go from here? Like what sort of deranged organizations do we allow to operate in this very, very crude, very cynical, you know, hard, you know, like cold business environment? Like, well, we're just trying to sell tickets. It's like, I don't want to know where that goes as a fan, as a human being, as an American, as whatever. I don't want to see where that ends up.
Yeah. I think that's extremely well said. I wrote an article for SB Nation this year called It's Just Business. And it was based on obviously that phrase, but it's something I had been thinking about for honestly like a year and a half, that I was just like struggling how to get into, you know, how to go from one end to the other. But it's essentially, I mean, it's essentially about capitalism. And I'm not trying to, you know, look, you can get into whatever, again, like societal frameworks that you want, but like the end result, if you pursue pure capitalism, is that like people lose out and you have to just like say like, well, tough shit for them. But like when you talk about it's just business, like there's this quote, and I'm probably going to butcher it going from memory, but from a former chairperson of the board, Anu Aga, for Thermax, they were a chairperson. And it said basically like, yes, businesses exist to make money, yes, businesses need to make money, but they can't exist to make money. And they basically said like, we have lungs, but our purpose isn't to breathe, right? Like our purpose as people is not to breathe, but we need air to breathe, right? We need air and we need our lungs and we need all that to breathe, but that is not our purpose. Similarly, like a business needs money. A business needs to make money, but that can't be its purpose. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about sports, and this is something I think about all the time with baseball, and that's generally where I focus, but it's 100% true of the NFL, the NBA, all of these things. What is the purpose? When we allow people to say it's a business, sure, yes, of course. But what are we saying about that? Does that mean we're just excusing them for devaluing people, for devaluing how to, you know, how, not only the like the people on their staff, but how those, you know, how people are treated, all that kind of thing? I think it is a shorthand for all of that. And I don't think it should be. Business, we can have ethical businesses. And I also, one thing I was thinking about when you were saying it, you know, people have short memories and you know, they might not remember what Roberto Osuna did or Kareem Hunt, or, I mean, we're bringing up
the list goes on
because we're for, yeah. You know, the list is so extensive that we might not remember, yeah. But it's not only that we have short memories. I don't want to put that on the fans or the consumers of these sports. It's because, there are so many. I mean, it's overwhelming. How could anyone possibly keep track and keep and remember all of these things and then kind of devise a philosophical or societal approach that allows them to operate? I mean, this goes back to like, well, you want to look at like the lesson of the Good Place or whatever, is like, essentially there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, right? Like every choice you make is potentially at the behest of an unethical or bad actor in our society, because like there are so many and so many of them dominate various, you know, means of production, so to speak. But like we need teams to be the guiding forces for us as fans. We shouldn't be in the position. I mean, it's a lot like anything with COVID and how the government responded to it. People were forced to choose between like, how do I deal with my work? How do I deal with my kids? What risks do I take? What exposure? A lot of those things shouldn't have been, you know, okay, so you're a bartender and your state said, yeah, we can have in restaurant dining and people at the bars. That's your career. That's your job. You're not getting money for it now. Do you go work? You understand it's a bad decision. You understand that being inside, based on the science, says this is a huge exposure risk and that people shouldn't do it. What is the choice? Well, the reality is that person shouldn't be in that position to make that choice. And my argument would be like, as fans, we shouldn't be in the put in the position of remembering the litany of people who have done horrible things and received chance after chance after chance. And have to, you know, reconcile all of that ourselves.
Yeah.
Some of, maybe not all of it, but some of that should be taken care of by the ethical, ethical and good faith decisions being made by the teams that are giving these guys these, you know, giving or not giving these guys these chances.
Yeah. Yeah. Or by Manfred.
Or by, you know, this is, and, you know, look, it's a very fraught process, right? Like the Osuna stuff, he was suspended for a record number of games for something that he was not guilty of a crime on. He was not. Look, I have no doubts about the validity of that suspension. And I think there's something to be said about like the fact that like, should he be eligible to play for major league teams? I think he probably should. Like there was the crime, so to speak, and there was the punishment. It was levied by the league. He served his time. He's eligible. But I think the teams need to make a better set of decisions. And that doesn't mean never giving him a chance or whatever, but you, there needs to be accountability, right? Yeah. So that's the big thing to me with Osuna in his specific situation. He's always said, I'm not talking about that. I'm not getting into it. I'm refusing to do it. Okay, well then how do I, as a fan, give you any credit for, we talk about, I just said crime and punishment, but like, I also need you to like be a better person coming out of the other end of that. And I have no evidence that he's recognized what he did was wrong and ways that he's gone about to try and make, not only make amends, but, or, you know, it might be that he'll never be able to make amends with the person that he abused. And that's their choice. And I support them in that.
Yeah.
But he needs to go about, you know, maybe he needs to speak to people, you know, at risk abusers or whatever, and say, here's how, like, not to act. Here's what happened to me. Learn from my story. But we don't get any of that. And then teams are still taking him in. And I think there's a marked difference between someone who recognized what they did and have made some effort to correct it or to live better going forward. Some things are not correctable. I think we have to acknowledge that. And people who just say like, yeah, well, I can throw 98. So I'm back, baby. Yeah. You know, like whatever. Like, and that, again, that needs to be from the team. I shouldn't have to do that on my own.
Yeah. 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 I think you hit on this earlier when talking about organizations, right? If a company makes gazillions of dollars, but it pollutes the ocean, it erodes at the fabric of the planet and everybody else, right? And it's like, okay, well, we agree, we have agreed essentially through laws that, like, for the most part, that like organizations should not be allowed to do this, right? Like there has to be the same standard within sports, that it's like there's infractions and then there's things that erode at the essence of why we have sport in the first place, and you put us in difficult situations. Like yourself, how do I bring this up? You're like, I should not be put in this difficult situation, right? Like there should be, you know, guidelines for this. I think this is similar, different topic, but like steroids is the same thing, right? I don't know this quite as well, but like in 2002, when you had the Miller report, and you saw, if you were Bud Selig and you saw this big list of guys who were accused or tied to, you know, some sort of steroid, like, and you wanted to ban them or you wanted to punish them, it's like, okay, well then like there goes 90% of our revenue. And you know, the league itself is then faced with a decision where it's like, well, we are a business though. And if I ban all these people, we're insolvent. So like, there's gotta be like a point. I don't know if it's in the, I don't know. I mean, like here we are trying to solve the world's problems, which, you know, I'm sure people debated about, but like it's similar with steroids and even with remembering these players and honoring them in the Hall of Fame, and then debates about what the Hall of Fame is. Well, the Hall of Fame is just a museum, right? And a museum documents history. So they should be documented, right? Like we're crossing so many lines here. I don't have any answers, certainly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think steroids are a really interesting point. So I'm like explicitly, I don't like, on social media or in my writing really or anything, get into the Hall of Fame stuff, because I think it's just so, it's kind of so far sideways already that it's just kind of like not worth my time. So steroids, my opinion is that like the number, so we don't know who was using and who wasn't, first of all. I mean, we have the report, right? But there are also people who are like, if you talk to enough people in the game, like you're going to hear like a very high confidence level that a lot of people who weren't even on that report were using. So like, how do you separate one from the other? Because it was legitimately like, it's the steroid era. Like, how do you account for that? So are you not letting anyone in that era in the Hall of Fame? You know, I don't know. I don't really know how to go about doing that. So my reaction is kind of like, I think you just let them in and put context around it, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you have to give them a, you know, like there's a difference between like the plaques and the not, and like if you want to not give them a plaque, like I probably won't argue with you. I it's just hard for me, like as with other things, there are multiple approaches here that I think could make sense. But I also think like you want to go back to, you mentioned about Hank Aaron and his, you know, was never tied to steroids, but many people in his era used greenies, used amphetamines. And it is, you know, like those guys are all in the hall and they were not allowed. and they used them. And it was about getting some more energy for the when you had a long day, long series, whatever. You took it, you felt a little better. Okay, well, that's, if you want to talk about effect, like that's a lot of how a lot of us use caffeine. You know, okay, we're not going to draw that line. I think that's taking it to an illogical endpoint, to be very clear. But like it does, you have to like go through the whole process of like who used what and how and why and who's already in and not and all of those types of things. And I think it just becomes like impossible for me to argue against steroid users being out for me. Other people are going to feel differently and they might say, expel the lot of them. And so be it. I think that's a potentially valid option as well. But I think when you talk about, I think the greenies thing is one of the ones I think people don't really interact with as much because a lot of their heroes use them.
Gary Sheffield.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's one of those things. The other part with PEDs and steroids specifically is like, you don't magically get better by taking them, right? So one interesting way to look at it, at least to me, is that like they allow you to do more work, right? So what they allow you to do is your muscles to respond mm-hmm. faster Say you do a hard day at the gym, right. Then you take some steroids, some PEDs, yeah. And you get back at it the next day. Yep. You're actually yeah. putting in more work than other right. people to become better. Now, I think that's a bullshit way to look at it and to like sell it to people, but there you can see the frame of thought there, right? You know what I mean? Like you can say like that person is actually in a way working harder. Now again, I think it's unethical. It's against the rules. You should not do it. But people act like it's a shortcut and yeah. you automatically become very strong by taking these things. And that is expressly not the truth.
Yeah.
And then you get into like how helpful are they actually? And the reality is like we really don't know. Right. For some people, seemingly extremely helpful. For others, not so much. And weighing all of those things to me becomes, you know, there's a theme, but like weighing all of those things and having me be responsible for like interpreting all of that, I don't know how to do it. And that's kind of where I said, I just like throw up my hands. I don't engage with it very often because it's just like, it's so screwy. It's so sideways already that I don't know how to weigh all of that.
Yeah.
Well, I think the broader theme in part, at least, is that if you look at everybody that's in the Hall of Fame, probably with very few exceptions, all of them did something that was not perfectly ethical, either in the game or out of the game, right? Sure. Tons of pitchers for years have been doctoring balls in various ways.
Gossage. Yep.
Right. Guys have been doing weird shit on and off the field. So how do we just take, as you said, this one era that probably more people than were in the Miller report were doing it, most likely. How do we just take this and say, well, we're going to throw the lot of them out? Right. It sort of doesn't align, I think, with what's already in there.
Yeah. I mean, I think. And it might not be compelling to people, and I think that's okay. But my approach would be to put them in and say, here's the context under which this happened, and be honest about what we know and what we don't, and let people make those choices for themselves. I mean, the reason these arguments are rehashed again and again, and for some people, not for me, but for some people, they're very fun, is that like everyone's going to interpret it differently, and I think that's honestly fine. But I think they should. You know, I think there's a lot of sanctimony from baseball writers and the people who vote for the Baseball Writers Association of America, the people who vote these people into the Hall of Fame. I think there's a lot of sanctimony about that and a misunderstanding of kind of like what this is all about. And I understand it is an honor, but it's an honor that, again, like relative to their peers in their era, like I don't know how you separate one from the other. I don't know how you segregate users from non-users when there's so much we don't know. And so it should really be about doing our, and again, like the sanctimony to me comes in that like a lot of these guys were covering them at the players at the time, the writers were covering the players at the time and not talking about it at the time. And it's like, you know, now you're punishing them. And beyond that, like you get into a lot of people, there's a very high correlation of people who vote for Bonds and Clemens together or not together, right? Like they see them as steroid era representatives and that kind of thing. And you know, a lot of that is how they, those guys in particular, treated the media. There's a lot of like retaliation from media of guys who weren't kind to the media, weren't generous with their time. There's a lot of like personal grudges being settled in these things. And it's amazing to me, you know, we're talking about kind of a lot of these guys being bad actors in a lot of ways. Like Barry Bonds has a domestic abuse record. Roger Clemens has like a sleeping with a minor situation in his past. You get Mindy McCready, like you can look that up. These like, I think there are ethical reasons not to put them on the ballot or not to vote for them on your ballot. But I struggle with those ethical reasons being like the sanctimony of they subverted the game. Because I don't really think, you know, again, in context that they did that. I think that, you know, that should have been settled kind of at the time and not retroactively. And that if they got in, we should be very honest and clear about those subversive actions, right. but that they're not a reason to not put them in, if that makes sense.
Right. This reminds me of Canseco's point. Jose Canseco said like, Mark McGwire should be in the Hall of Fame because he saved baseball the year after the strike. The home run race brought back so many fans, and like Barry Bonds was just acting selfishly. And so those are two people who took steroids who really benefited from it, but for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
In the point you just brought up, then should someone like Mark McGwire be more likely to make a Hall of Fame as compared to like a Barry Bonds?
I think McGwire's statistical case is pretty lacking ultimately. I mean, he's got the home runs, but if you want to account what he did for baseball into that, I'd have trouble arguing with you. I wouldn't weight it that heavily, but I don't think he should have a plaque. Like he should be a Hall of Famer, but he can be at Cooperstown. I think he should be recognized for what he did for baseball, you know, what he and Sosa did for baseball at Cooperstown at the museum, right? But mm-hmm. I don't think he is a Hall of Famer.
Right.
And that's maybe a distinction without a difference to some people, and that's okay. You know, it's a very thin line to walk, but that's kind of what makes sense to me. But if someone said, I think those contributions push him into a place where he should be recognized with a plaque and he should have a Hall of Fame, you know, like I don't weight it that heavily, but it's really hard for me to argue with something like that. I mean, it's an intangible thing. And we're all going to weigh that differently.
Yeah, that's fair. Speaking of, doctoring the ball, going beyond the bounds of what might be allowed, as well as what we consider to be ethical behavior. Trevor Bauer, mm-hmm. Cy Young Award winner, is a free agent, and he's drumming up a lot of excitement about where he's going to end up. Can we get you to weigh in on if you had to make a prediction where Trevor Bauer is going to play next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few potential fits for him. I'm going to say this with the caveat that like none of this is an endorsement. And I don't earnestly think many of the teams, I think they care about a backlash to potentially signing him, but I don't think it's going to matter enough to impact their decision. You know what I mean? They're just going to, I don't think anyone's going to say like, well, you know, ultimately we can't do it because we think it's, I think because of the reasons we discussed about how teams approach the game and the business and wanting to win, although a lot of them also try not to win, so it's complicated. I ultimately think it's not that big a factor, his off the field stuff, and that it should be a bigger factor is my personal feeling on it. But I think Toronto is an option. They just signed George Springer. They really need rotation help, and they brought in some pitchers. They just brought in. They re-signed Robbie Ray after trading for him last year. They just brought in Tyler Chatwood, but their rotation is really, really weak behind Hyunjin Ryu. And he fits like for where they are as a team on the field, he fits them really pretty well. I also think some of this is going to depend on whether he wants a major multi-year deal like his nemesis Gerrit Cole, or whether he wants to go year to year like he talked about. And I think if he goes year to year, you could see someone like St. Louis being involved. depending on how much he wants. Obviously, you'd take a higher annual average annual value on a shorter term deal. I think a team like San Francisco is kind of interesting. They're not there right now, but they have a really good farm system in a lot of ways. A lot of those guys are pretty far off, but they Farhan Zaidi has done a really good job of, you know, discovering Alex Dickerson, stealing essentially Mike Yastrzemski from the Orioles. Like, these guys are legitimately good. Their last several major pitching expenditures haven't gone super well. Johnny Cueto, Jeff Samardzija, that type of thing. But like, what they don't have in the farm really is a ton of pitching, and especially high end pitching coming up. And so, you know, you've got Joey Bart at the major league level already. He's a really good catcher defensively. I think it would be a year, maybe a year and a half to two early for them. But again, if you're signing a 6 to 7 to, you know, again, Garrett Cole got 9 years. If you're signing a major long-term deal, you don't always worry about year one or year two. The complicated factor in that is that, like, usually year one and year two are the best years you're going to get for these type of guys.
Yep.
But it is, you know, you see teams do that with the Nationals did it with Jason Wirth way back in the day. They signed him until he was age 39. They knew they weren't going to get the best years of his career by the time that they were relevant, but they needed someone there in the meantime to start saying, like, we're building something. I personally, look, I don't have any intel on any of this kind of stuff. I personally think San Francisco could fit that mold. It's just, I don't know. I for some reason that sticks out to me. I mean, look, he's a potential top of the rotation pitcher. You can slot him in almost every, the Mets have been rumored to have interest in him. I think they also make a fair bit of sense, but contrary to the Giants, they have a lot of pitching. Right. Like, Noah Syndergaard is going to come back at some point this year. They signed Marcus Stroman to the qualifying offer. He's there for another year. They, you know, they have Jacob DeGrom, the best pitcher in baseball. Pitching is not where they're hurting. And so, like, would he be a nice piece for a guy that's worth $14 billion and can spend whatever he wants? Sure. But, you know, if you're talking about strictly on field fits, about teams that are coming up, and you know, the other factor for San Francisco is that they've brought in some driveline guys, especially on the pitching side.
Yeah.
And Bauer is an avowed driveline pitcher. So, I mean, I think, you know, if Philly decided they wanted to spend, they could really use an arm behind Nola and Wheeler. And it would make a lot of sense, again, on the field, I'm talking about specifically. And they also have some driveline people in-house, I think more on the hitting side than pitching. But again, like, these are kind of ancillary factors, and the base factors on the field only are that he's got a really, you know, the potential to be a top of the rotation guy, and you can slot those types in almost anywhere.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, as Giants fans, I mean, I'd say it'd be a nice ad for us. I mean, as you said, we have nobody at the top of the rotation right now, right? I mean, what, Kevin Gausman's going to be the number one, and he's got good stuff, but you know, one year of kind of performance at this point. So
yeah, and I really admire what Zaidi's, you know, I mentioned the hitters, but like Gausman, number one, they made Wirth offering and him accepting the qualifying offer, and Drew Smyly,
yeah,
and got an $11 million deal, which shocking to me when that happened. But you know, I think I mentioned earlier, like, teams pay for what they project, not what's happened. Yep. And his velocity jumped by 2 miles an hour. If Atlanta looked at that data and said, we think this is sustainable, then they're paying for something. $11 million could look like a steal based on what he showed in San Francisco. Whether he can stay healthy, I would guess not. But, you know, credit to Zaidi and the pitching staff in San Francisco for, like, turning those guys around. Gausman had not figured it out in both Atlanta and Baltimore or Cincinnati. And Cincinnati has a really good pitching staff that, again, we were talking about Bauer, but, like, they took Derek Johnson, a coach from Vanderbilt, and said, like, we want you to use all the data and analytics that you're using there here. And they turned Sonny Gray around, and Gray went to Vanderbilt. So some of that is that relationship. Yeah. And that goes back to, by the way, projections capturing everything. How do you do that? How do you if Sonny Gray went to another team that used analytics the same way Derek Johnson does, they have a different relationship. So what he says, I could say the same thing and it's going to have a different outcome. And my favorite example of that is Dave Stewart. You know, he was cut from the Dodgers. He was cut from multiple teams, went to Oakland and he started working with, I think it was Dave Duncan. And he said, like, this is the guy, like, I understand when he talks. Hmm. And Dave Stewart became a two-time 20-game winner, Cy Young winner. That's about communication. And we've seen this with other Liam Hendricks, who just signed with the White Sox as a free agent, was in Oakland. And he was touting this guy that he goes to who has a business called Codify about kind of the way he gives data and that kind of thing. And I've looked at the stories that have talked about Codify, which I'm at BP. I'm interested in that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is stuff most teams don't have, but he's communicating it in a way that these guys understand. And Liam Hendricks said something that was really interesting to me. And I think frankly is kind of a bad look on Oakland. He said the way that this guy, Michael Fisher, presents the information is all in a positive way. He says, throw it here, you know, throw these pitches in these spots, these kind of things, versus Oakland, who was saying, avoid these areas. Don't do this. Don't do that. And he said, I want to hear things in a positive framing. And that helps me understand it. And like, look, it's hard to believe it's that simple, but sometimes it's that simple that like, this is the way his brain understands and implements things better. You know, again, how do you project something like that?
Well, you were talking about behavioral economics, man. I mean, that's behavioral economics 101 is framing. And that's what you're talking about is like there's positively framed messages and there's negatively framed messages, gain or loss framed messages. And the positive framing, what you're talking about being more effective, at least for Liam Hendricks, tends to be more effective overall in communicating with people than negative kind of framed message. So, I mean, it makes sense. All of what you're saying makes sense.
Right. And that's something like you guys know based on what you study and all that kind of thing. But like it's hard. Like I said, it's kind of a bad look to me on Oakland that like, first of all, if Liam Hendricks is cognizant enough to know how he better receives information, like that should be in entrance and exit interviews, right? All this stuff should be tailored to the individual. I mean, you can take the same mass data and say like our big approach is this, but the smaller approach is the individual stuff is like, how are we going to give that info to you? Yeah. And some of these guys are going to say, I learn how I learn. Like, I don't know how that is.
Yeah.
But some of them do know enough about themselves to say like, this is how I like to receive it. And the other thing they should be doing, of course, is saying like, you may like to receive it that way, but do you best receive it that way? I mean, those are different things, right?
Yeah.
How do we, I think it's a great point. I think it was Ariel Cohen who said something similar. It was like, how do we catch up with this kind of stuff? And I think it was the bat, Derek Carty's, he tries to take in this information like, oh, this guy over the offseason has been working on this, or he's got a new coach or whatever, to try and factor into some of these, you know, predictive models. But like, you're right. You mentioned this earlier and you're a post-positivist because we'll get infinitely close to, but we'll never be perfect. We're always going to be chasing, I think, these themes.
So the big T truth.
Yeah. We'll get close, but we won't get there.
Yeah.
My daughter is telling me from the other room that she's done napping.
She's banging on the wall.
Wrap it up. Craig, this was a lot of fun. We solved, I think, the world's problems. We covered a lot of deep topics. I had a great time. This was so much fun.
Likewise. This was awesome. I'm happy to be here and happy to do it again if you ever need.
Would love to. Yeah, definitely. Please rate and subscribe where applicable to the show. We really appreciate it. Thanks as always to our editing team for putting together today's show. Craig, you are on Twitter at
CD Goldstein. I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, you just did.
I just want to know. I want people to know what to avoid.
That's fair. Yeah. Well, you do a lot of writing, so I think that might be better targeted material. Obviously, at Baseball Prospectus.
Yep.
We're on Twitter at HeadGamePsych. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Brett Levine, and you can find that guy on Twitter at BD Rosenberg PhD. And thanks as always for tuning in.